Welcome to Fright School. Are you ready? Class is in session. Welcome back to Fright School. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Joshua.
Sorry, Joe's mad at me because he wanted me to start the podcast with a Beyonce reference, but I don't need her suing me.
I'll do it, you know.
Her and her 50 writers.
I wanted him to, like, before he said, you know, welcome back to Fright School, I want him to go, unique!
Yep, and now we're sued. So thank you for listening to the show. We'll be in debtor's prison.
With Khalees and Shakira.
Yes. Yay. Super fun. It's going to be a party.
Yeah. It's basically 2005 all over.
Yeah. I do want to clarify, because I made a joke about Beyonce's 50 writers. I do understand how sampling works and interpolations work, unlike Diane, whatever her name is.
Diane Warren.
Yes.
Almost said Diane von Furstenberg, but this is different.
Diane von Furstenberg.
Wait, can you hold on? So explain the controversy.
Oh, well, she's a songwriter, and I think she's even written for Beyonce in the past and others. Like, she's written for a ton of people. And so on Twitter, she just, like, posted a tweet, like, you know, why does a song have 24 writers? And, you know, and I think she had another tweet that was like, you know, my songs are written by one person, me, you know, that kind of thing. And
white lady.
Yeah, so of course, and a lot of people came for her and was like, well, a lot of these songs are using a lot of samples, so they're, you know, referencing a lot of other music. Mm-hmm. So it's pulling from, you know, a lot of different sources that need to be credited. I'm so glad we're talking about this a month after it happened. Basically, by the time this gets to your earballs.
But I mean, like, I think it's important for context, because, yeah, you know, people may not know.
I agree.
I didn't know.
Yeah.
I knew the beef, but I also was just like, it's kind of like that. But that meme has been going around a lot for Beyonce, where it's, yeah, like, you know, Run the World parentheses girls, and they, yeah, put that side by side with, like, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody,
or yeah.
And it's like, you know, it's more than that. It's a collaborative process, and you honor everyone who is in the room. Like,
yeah,
who knows who may be lost to history in Freddie Mercury space, if there was maybe one person who, maybe one or two people who, like, contributed to that meaningfully.
Right, who
were
given,
just,
like,
left out. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's always a dramatic thing in bands. You know, you hear, like, I actually just recently, you know, a month or so ago, I saw the Chicks, you know, formerly the Dixie Chicks, in concert. And every time I see them in concert, it always makes me want to go back and revisit their Shut Up and Sing documentary, which kind of tracks their the whole incident that, you know, where they said they were embarrassed or ashamed of, you know, President Bush being from Texas, and then the making of their record, and then they won, you know, all the Grammys. So there's a sequence in there where I think it's... I'm really bad because it's a male band, but it's like maybe a drummer of somebody's band. Maybe it's the Red Hot Chili Peppers, or maybe it's Pearl Jam, or maybe it's... And again, I'm not trying to compare these bands, but just saying it's like a guy in a 90s band, one of them that I don't know. And they're having a conversation about songwriting royalty split. And he's saying, we split everything equally. And, like, Natalie Maines is like, I wouldn't feel right about that. Like, if I didn't write the song, I shouldn't get a credit on it. Like, you know... like, shouldn't the lead singer, like, wouldn't you feel, like, embarrassed about that or something, you know, or, like, whatever. They have a whole conversation about that. And so for some people, it's, we're just splitting it diplomatically, so there's no problem. Everybody, you know, which is always how I act, you know, that is how I approach it. Like, on, you know, the record that we made, everybody is credited as the songwriters. You know, there's one song on the record that was written partially by a friend of mine, not in the band. So that person is, of course, credited. But other than that, it's just, I think, easier. Like, because, like, certainly, yeah, I wrote a lot of the lyrics and the melodies, but I didn't write the drum parts. I didn't write the, you know,
it's
the
guitars, a collaborative
the
process.
Bass. Yeah. So it's, yeah, like, I feel like it's fine to give credit to everybody. And if it makes people feel like they're part of the band and, like, are contributing in a way, like, I don't see any problem with that. But again, you know, these are people talking millions of dollars, so that's a different level.
Yeah.
Whatever. The point is, like, you know, write your songs, don't write your songs, whatever. Just, you, like, you know, keep your mouth shut sometimes. Like, think about what you're going to say before you say it. what is it? Do as I say, not as I do, I guess, in that way. I'm super excited because right now, if you're listening to this, I should be in Cancun to wrap up my summer before I head off into this first week of grad school. So to that end, Joe, I actually really liked your idea. A little bit of production. You're hearing a little bit of production happening because we're recording, a little. We're doing some, it's behind the scenes trickery. So
this is behind the scenes trickery.
So the point is that yes, while you're listening to this, I am on vacation and am preparing for my very first week of grad school, which is fun. We're wrapping up our episodes on giant monsters, and I'm about to tackle my own in the form of a master's degree.
Are you excited?
I am very excited, but it's going to be a lot of work, and I feel like my life is going to be like school and fright school.
It's just your two schools.
It's going to be like trying to find every spare minute I can of like studying and then bothering you until we record, Like, come on, can we record 6 episodes today so that we can have a break? I'm super, super excited, and it's been such a great summer, and I actually really like your idea. We're wrapping up. We're here at the end of August. September's coming, back to school. I'm really looking forward to our month of shows coming up. It's going to be a fun nostalgic whiplash. So I thought your little idea before the show to kind of look back on our summer.
Did you hear that, listener? Joshua liked one of my ideas.
Yeah. So Joe, what about the summer? What is a couple highlights for you?
I guess.
And keep an eye on the clock. Let's try to keep this short.
I get a clock. He gets to ramble on incessantly about, fucking. He's looking.
We're
over
at 7 minutes. So what can you
eat dirt and die trash? highlights, right? So I guess like the big highlight, and again, I'm not saying that this particular thing is not a positive highlight, but it is a highlight nonetheless. I got COVID.
Right.
I got the Coco.
Lady Rona visited. You had a visitor this summer.
I had a visitor.
Good for you.
I was going to say my monthly visitor.
Friend.
My friend Coco Ronya came and Coco Ronya, that'll be, Drag Race season 15.
Right.
Hi, I started doing drag in 2020. Then that was really like, it's interesting because I was talking with another friend who has been on the show, but I will not name them because they did not give me permission. And I was asking them about what it was like to have it, especially being up until that point that they got it so diligent about, exposure,
right,
and doing quote unquote everything right and all of
whatever
this,
that means.
Whatever that means for them, right? And they were saying that it sucks, having the sickness, it's never good to fun or to be sick, but at the same time it's like a sense of relief because you're getting it, but that the chances that you're going to be hospitalized and or die are significantly less. So,
oh gosh, it gave me flashbacks to statistics. I don't even want to think about it.
So, statistical.
Was there a significant?
Yes,
statistically significant. Anyways, not the point. Go ahead.
But yeah, so that was a highlight because I was alone for basically 10 days with my thoughts. I laid down and let my body heal. And, I got a shout out to, again, I can't mention them, don't have their consent, but shout out to another friend who she had gotten it a long time ago and she had gotten it early in the year and was, giving all this really great advice, and our experiences were different. Like hers seemed like it knocked her out more than it did me. Like my energy was fairly up. But one thing that she told me was your body is strong. Your body is strong. It is fighting this. It has everything it has everything at the moment it needs to fight this. Vaccines, you know, supportive care, medicine, all that stuff. So I was like, wow, that was really nice. So I just kept that, and like, it was a mantra, and I tried as much as possible to internalize that.
I love that.
Yeah, so that was definitely like a highlight, you know, not great, but
yeah,
you know,
still, a lesson learned.
A lesson learned. Let's see, if we're thinking back from like end of May, right? So like the Labor Day weekend, or Memorial Day weekend. Yeah, I had like really great, I had a really great Pride. That was also really nice. Got to see some movies, spend time with you in person again, once again.
You can stop there. That's so sweet. Yes. That's the highlight of your summer.
I mean, it felt like a summer. Like last year was weird because I was, you know, out of town for some family stuff. It was like, do we feel okay doing what we're doing?
Right.
There was still like that, like lingering, maybe we shouldn't be as available to do things. But, you know, even now, like that's still definitely a question we should be asking. But and taking whatever precautions you need, listener, to take. But yeah, it was just overall, it was just like the simple pleasures of like the things that I would have always been, what I would have been doing, you know, pre-COVID, which was just like going to the movies and seeing friends. I went into a Target the other day, and I walked into the Target. I completely forgot that I didn't have a mask on.
Yeah.
And usually when I go into big public spaces like that, you know, it's a, you know, people come and go. I'm masked, but like I knew I needed to get this one thing.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I usually order the Target stuff online, do the drive up, and now I'm like, I'll just walk in. And then like I was like, oh, holy shit. Like I felt it was weird. But at the same time, I'm like, have I reached that point for me where like, you know, I have like five masks in the car, but I just completely forgot.
Yeah.
Never mind.
No, it's just some breathe.
Oh, okay. I thought I was like, did you take a hit of poppers?
No, it's just something from my
like
keep my sinuses open.
I know you got a lot of physical media, so you probably need to clean, you know, the
not VHS. Anything that requires fucking that popper stuff. You know,
sorry.
I don't use the poppers because that's not my position.
Yeah. that's not my role. Yeah. What about you, Joshua? What were your like? I mean, you did comparatively way more than. I mean, I felt like you did more and got more out there this summer.
Well, I mean, yeah, we went to London. That was a big highlight for me. I thoroughly enjoyed that this summer. Obviously, can't go to another country on vacation and like totally hate it. Well, I mean, I guess you can.
Like most Americans.
Yeah,
most ugly Americans abroad.
I certainly know plenty of people who can complain, which is what's so funny about like. You know, like I said, as this is airing, you know, I should be over on, you know, Melissa Etheridge's island doing that whole thing. And there's already like the Facebook is just full of people whining and complaining. And it's like, you know, at a certain point, it's like the cheapest room at this fucking thing is still pretty expensive, you know?
Yeah.
If you can afford to be on this fucking island, your life probably isn't all that bad. You know, like, come, you know, quit like making this so messy so early before you're even there. So that's a little frustrating, but I'm really glad because on the opposite side, you know, we got a very, very nice room because we're celebrating our 14th anniversary. We're celebrating my graduation.
There's a lot to celebrate.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I graduated, you know, this summer, got my diploma, you know, all of that. Well, I got the diploma, I guess, in the summer, but I graduated at the end of spring, you know, started a new program that'll, you know, be going. So it's like, you know, a lot to celebrate. You know, so we kind of went all out and I'm really glad we did because, I kind of just want to stay in my room, like, you know, hanging out in our very nice suite and then just go over, watch the concerts. You know, El King's going to play, Ani DeFranco's going to play, Delta Ray's going to play, you know, a whole bunch of other people. And then, of course, Melissa, obviously. So, you know, we're going to go to a few things, but I'm like, I'm kind of looking forward to sort of not being around too many of these complaining, whining, like, you know, people. A lot of them are white.
Certain level of entitlement.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just so sad to me because I think about all the people who, you know, because there's a lot of people in the groups and stuff because they've been on the cruises or they wanted to. And it's like, oh, I can't afford to do that. I can't afford to do this. I can't afford to do that. You know, so it's like, man, you know, you should just feel really lucky that one, the world is back to a place where we feel comfortable enough to travel, comfortable enough to, you know, get on planes and go places and do things. And we should like celebrate the fact that we can do that.
Yeah.
You know,
because
plenty of people cannot. You know, so why you're, you know, panicking about, you know, the dumb stuff that people panic about before these things, because they want to know every detail before they get there, which part of me understands that. I'm similar, mm-hmm. you know, in the sense, but it's like, that's on me. That's not on like everybody else to like bend their world to, you know, your desire to know exactly what time, you know, a certain restaurant on the island opens. Like, there are like 19 restaurants that are open, and several of them are 24 hours. Calm the fuck down. You'll be able to eat.
Yeah.
Because that was the thing. Everybody was panicking because it was like, the restaurants aren't open till 6. I'm like, they're not going to bring 2,000 fucking Americans to a resort and not feed them till 6 p.m. every day. Like, that is not a thing. Calm down, lady.
Yeah.
It was just bonkers.
Hold
the
on.
Things that people,
people
panic
are like
about.
Actually concerned about that
stuff
shit?
Stuff like that. Yeah, yeah. Like, none of the restaurants open till 6. I'm like, no, a couple of the fancy ones open for dinner only, but there's a bunch of buffets and other things. Like, calm down.
Like, you can get food.
Yes. Like, yeah, it's like, no, nobody's going to be able to eat till 6 p.m. every day. And guess what? That's exactly when Melissa's going to play, so you're going to have to choose. You eat or you see the concert. Like, I mean, it's dumb.
Is it really?
You know? No, it's not like that. I mean, it's just so
no,
dumb.
No, but, like, is Melissa, like, playing at the same time when the restaurant's open?
Well, okay. No, most of her shows are late. They're, like, 9:30 to 10:30.
Okay.
You know, or 9:30 to 11 or something, you know. All the artists play usually once or twice on the boat. You know, they play, mm-hmm. you know, 45 minutes, or I guess this time it's not on the boat. It's, you know, the island thing, mm-hmm. but the festival. But most people play for, like, 45 minutes to an hour and a half, you know, mm-hmm. depending on their level of fame and the hierarchy of the island, you know, sure. the whole thing of the festival.
Yes. This very bureaucratic,
yeah.
patriarchal island.
Yeah. So, but again, it's just like any music festival, you know, like, and that happens to me all the time, because a lot of times the people I love that are at a music festival are not the headliner, so they get like 30 minutes on like the Z stage, and mm-hmm. I gotta like go see them. And then be sad that I spent all this money to see like two bands play, you know. So again, why I don't go to a lot of festivals, because I'm not. I'm usually not there for the big headliners.
Yeah,
you know. But anyway, so that's not the point. The point is yeah, London was amazing. The Dixie Chicks concert, or the Chicks, you know, I'm still trying to shake that as well. The Chicks concert was great. We saw a lot of other great shows that I cannot remember. But, you know, that's me and my frickin' brain. Yeah, it was a really good summer. I read a lot of good books, you know, having fun in the book clubs. And mm-hmm.
Did you read any people?
Yes, I read people to filth, left mm-hmm. and right. Speaking of book clubs, you know, make sure you join us if you haven't, like, join our Patreon, join the book club, get All That's Left in the World by Eric J. Brown. We're going to be discussing the book with him. So you'll want to definitely join the event. We also should have him on the show. That's the plan, but we shall see.
We shall see.
The goal is for all the scheduling to work out. But yeah, it's been a really great summer. You know, so far I've not caught the monkeypox, which is good.
Lovely.
Trying to avoid that shit. You know, and I do know a lot of people that did get COVID and got really sick and like stayed in their house for weeks and weeks on end and did not get to enjoy the summer the way they would have liked. Mm-hmm. So I am, I just have to be grateful, you know?
Yeah.
At the end of the day, you know, gratitude.
An attitude.
Yes.
Of gratitude.
An attitude of gratitude. Beatitudes.
Yes.
I have no idea. I'm just rhyming.
Do you know what the Beatitudes are?
Like, I have like a vague idea.
Blessed are like religion. The poor in spirit.
Yeah.
Blessed are the poor in spirit, longing for their Lord. Aww. For God's coming kingdom shall be there. It's a song. It's a hymn.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Go you, Joe.
See, now, you know, you're worried about Beyonce suing you. Now the Catholic Church, they need money. They need to pay out. Anyway, yeah, it was a really great summer. It was like anyone who knows me knows that like my big theme for anything in my life and you know the is like my just desire to be in community with people and being able to like pride and the parade, while important and nice and the spectacle it all was great, but just being able to like after like leave the parade, go have like a very fun and casual lunch with another couple, and then like meet up with some other friends, and then go and hang out at their apartment, and you know, just like flouncing around Hillcrest, and then like the next day, like going to a caftan brunch, and just those things of being able to do that without having to like run the checklist in my mind of like, okay, we're policing everyone's surveillance. We'll talk about this later, right? Like we have been talking about policing, surveillance, other people's behaviors. And like the other thing too about like community stuff is just knowing that folks are people are also have the same values. So like being in a place now, few years removed from pandemic, and like really kind of understanding that the people that I spend my time with are people whose values reflect mine. And I saw a lot of friends this summer that and was in like queer community.
Yeah.
Queer community was just so delightful. I think like a few weeks ago I had dinner with a friend and like we this is so gay. We like were leaving Extraordinary Desserts in like Bankers Hill area of San Diego, and we were driving up Sixth, and I like rolled down. I had my windows rolled down because you know it was nice outside, and he had my phone to play music, and I was like, yeah, be the DJ, do whatever you want, and he played like you know the big belty number from Lempicka, which is like a musical that like. It's not even on Broadway yet, and we like knew all the words and like we're belting it. Like it was so fucking
that's
fun
such a
and
sweet
queer.
Moment. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Well, I love that, you know, having that family and you know, and just being grateful for it. And that, you know, that was another highlight of my summer, having my brother come and visit with his, you know, with his wife and his kids. And for our differences, because we certainly have a lot of political and sociocultural viewpoints that diverge at certain places. It's really nice that even after, like, you know, after the death of our mother, like, you know, we have found like a really nice balance of being family and, you know, trying to control the drama in our lives and with each other and just, you know, be able to do fun things.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, that was also a massive highlight that I'm very grateful for having like real family, quote unquote, like in the sense of blood relations. I don't really define that as real family. You know, my real family are the people who truly support,
you know,
and connect, you know,
Western white suspicion.
But yeah. Yeah. You know, if we're talking about biological family, you know, so it was very cool to spend that time with them as well. So yeah, overall a really great summer. But thankfully it is gone. And the time of the spookiness, the spooky season is upon us.
Oh,
it is
God.
Rolling in the fog. And I'm ready. I'm ready for it. My powers are growing and growing and growing. I'm going to be as big as the Cloverfield monster.
Oh my God. So if you are the Supreme Rising, who is waning? Like whose powers are waning right now? Who's like looking like, you know, they're losing hair and chain smoking? Like,
I don't know who's like the queen of this past summer.
Oh my God.
Was it Beyonce?
It's gonna say it's Beyonce, isn't it?
Well, got bad news for her. So her face is cracking.
It's like, you may not break her soul, but you are coming for her gig.
No, I like to think that there's enough power for all of us, you know. I'm for sharing it. So it's okay.
Oh my God. Are you like for like you're for like a distribution of like
yes.
of a supernatural power.
Yes, yes, yes.
You
yes.
don't believe that Hecate like is yeah. about like, you know, patriarchal hierarchical structure.
No, I think it's about sharing. It's about empowering your fellow sisters, brothers, and siblings, and what nibblings is that what they call? You know, I've heard that word.
Nibbling is a. If eventually your brother's sons don't, one of them doesn't identify as either gender, as a non-binary, you would call them.
Oh, that's what the yeah. nibbling means. Well, still, for all of us, yes. You know, the same energy that I bring to Halloween, that energy, once I've expelled it, it leaves me and it goes to the Christmas people. And then they get to have that energy for a while and be, you know, bonkers crazy for Christmas. My
God. This is like a weird, like, like origin story. Like this is what you tell this is what we tell the primitive people have told each other about like how the seasons work.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No. I think that's fair, you know.
Joshua lights a candle in the West Craven Memorial Library on, you know, November 1st, and then once it is extinguished, it goes into a Santa Claus or...
Yeah, you know. I surrender it to the people who like the wintry yeah. holidays. Yeah. And they give it to the people who go fucking bonkers for New Year's. And then they give it to the Valentine's Day people. And then it just keeps moving on to yeah. July 4th and beyond. And then eventually finds its way back to me. And I celebrate Halloween once again.
That's beautiful. God, we're so saccharine today.
All right. Well, enough of this nonsensical stuff. We're going to come back and discuss 2008's Cloverfield.
Let's do it.
I just want to apologize. I'm sorry to everyone. I was very naive and very stupid, and I shouldn't have put other people in danger. I am so sorry for everything that has happened, because in spite of what Joshua says, it's now all my fault. I insisted our listeners subscribe to Fright School on Apple Podcasts. I insisted they leave us reviews. I insisted that they give us a 5-star rating. And it's all because of me that we're here now and we're being hunted. I love you, Mom and Dad. I am so sorry. I only wanted to make good content for our listeners. So scared. I'm going to die out here. Joshua, is that you?
All right, welcome back. We are wrapping up our, at least a unit devoted to giant monsters. There are still plenty out there. You know, I've heard from some of you, you know, why didn't you choose this one? Why didn't you choose that one? Listen, I want to get to all of them. Believe me, I want this show to go on forever. And please all of the fans out there. But as I am still in control, I'm choosing the films I want. So this time we're wrapping up with Cloverfield because, you know, we started with King Kong, we did Godzilla, we did Tremors, and now we're sort of doing what I feel is the most obvious film that has like kinship with Godzilla and like the Japanese people and sort of where Godzilla came from. We can see echoed in the way Cloverfield responds to particularly the events of 9/11. So we got on direction, you know, the Batman director, Matt Reeves, produced by J.J. Abrams, written by Drew Goddard, G-O-D-D-A-R-D.
Goddard, probably.
Goddard, yes. Michael Stahl David, Mike Vogel, Odette Gustman, Lizzie Kaplan.
Lizzie Kaplan's the reason.
Jessica Lucas and fucking TJ Miller again. How in like a month, a month ago we did Underwater with TJ Miller and now here he is again.
Okay, so this is going to be at the risk of like alienating people. Like why is he a piece of shit? Was he Me Too'd?
Yeah. I think he's been accused of assaulting an Uber driver. He reached a settlement with them. Sexual assault allegations that all came up within the Me Too movement. You know, several people said that he was very violent, choked, hit her, all without consent. You know, there's been others, and then in emails that he that were leaked, he had put all these. I think it was with the Sony leak thing.
Oh, yes.
It was, full of, transphobia.
It was the Sony leak.
Referring, to Danielle Soulsman as a weird, strange, terrible man, quote. That's his quote. So there were some other things. He did a fake bomb threat on the Amtrak, apparently, or, allegedly. So just a bunch of stuff and other misconduct accusations. So, yeah. He's
one of
those.
Shit. Yeah.
You know? So, yeah. Anyways, he's in this. We don't see much of him, but we hear him throughout the whole thing. I mean, he's the cameraman, basically.
Yeah,
throughout the whole.
He's the Greek chorus. He's providing commentary.
Yeah. So the film, it involves people at a going away party for their friend who's just got a promotion, is going to live this whole new life in
Japan.
Rob in Japan. And right, he's moving to Japan.
He's moving to Japan. He's like a vice president of something.
Yeah, which explains how they're all freaking affording these goddamn apartments in downtown, Manhattan or wherever the hell they are.
Yeah.
The film ends in Central Park, I guess. But
they're basically in Manhattan because they're trying to get off of Manhattan and Lula, what's her name? Whatever, the girl, the love interest, she's in Columbus Circle, overlooking the park.
Yeah, Lily.
Lily, thank you. Yeah. Something. Lula is Lizzie Kaplan's character from Now You See Me Too.
There we go. Anyway, they're celebrating, kind of. There's lots of drama between these, 30-somethings. And then a giant monster shows up and destroys their city and they have to survive. And it's a found footage film, so it's got lots going on. What I think is really cool is this is one of the very few films that we've done on Fright School. I'm guessing it's probably less than 10 that you've actually seen.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
in the theater.
Yeah. Talk about that.
So I saw this in the theater when it came out in 2008. Oh my God. I saw it with my cousin's now ex-husband because he's also a big spectacle movie fan. And this is, this is a pre-Marvel Cinematic Universe. So, we really didn't have much. You had horror and then you had some X-Men films and all that stuff. And so I completely bought into the hype of the viral marketing of this movie. Like you go to the website and then there's image that doesn't make any sense. As it got closer, there was a countdown clock and more images and then more things about the world that never really fully answered in the film, or at the same time, you never really get a sense that it was leading anywhere. You click random places to see if there's just a back door that you're not seeing that gets you more content. But I totally bought into it and I went and saw it, and it was one of the most interesting movie watching experience I've ever had, because on one side of things, it was great to see it on a big theater. I was part of I was really about, okay, I need to be there in the theater to see this movie. I can't wait to see what's going on. And the other part of it is that I got nauseous. I had to close my eyes for part of it. Like I, I like was such a hypochondriac. I'm such a hypochondriac. Like, I was convinced that I had epilepsy. Like, oh my God, you know, because at that point, but by the time I got to see it, they put like, you know, someone had already had like it triggered seizures for people. Yeah. People got nauseous and like were throwing up in theaters about it. Not because of disgust, but, you know, just the
motion sickness.
Yeah. And yeah. So like, and then the theater that we went to was like, hey, this movie got all these things. If you are affected, you better, like, you know, take a Dramamine. You better do what you need to do. But don't, you know, don't fucking yak in our theater. And the theater that I saw it in, too, was not like a stadium seating situation. It was like a traditional kind of like single level, but like it's raised a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think that was it, because I remember just like being like sinking into it and just feeling like it was so bigger and larger than life. And
yeah.
But yeah, absolutely. I just almost knocked over the microphone. yeah, it was just...
Well, you were getting a little nauseous watching it again today.
Yeah, I was like, man, I can't look at this. I can't look at this film. I was doing a lot better. That was the one thing. I don't know if I told you. I don't remember if I mentioned this when we did quarantine, but that was the one thing I was worried about with quarantine, was like being sick, being nauseous over it, which I was fine for quarantine, but not...
Yeah, well, yeah. I think the quarantine, kind of like the Blair Witch Project, which people also complained about, like having motion sickness, especially in the last, but it had a lot of scenes that were like pretty stationary.
And narrative,
because they're making a film within a film, and then in quarantine, they are trying to do like a newscast, and then he's trying to like document, so... It's not necessarily all the running around, but this, they just kind of stay moving.
Yeah, the people who are behind the cameras of Blair Witch and quarantine are professionals also.
Ideally, yes.
Ideally, they like that understand a camera and, like, you know, the cuts, you know, every choice is a lie, right? Every cut is a lie. So in this, it's just, you know, fucking, you know, douchebag schlub TJ Miller.
Going, well, yeah, HUD. He's not necessarily wanting to be the camera person. He's kind of stuck with it. Yeah. And then there he is. He just decides to, you know, try to document the whole situation.
Yeah.
And then we get it from his
perspective. View.
Yeah, his perspective.
So, yeah. So it brought back a lot of memories. This is another movie where it has, like, you know, all the men of my sexual awakening at the time.
Of course,
telling on myself, this is the year that I lose my virginity. A few months later, I will lose my man virginity. And like, yeah, I mean, it's got like Mike Vogel is in it, who's adorable. It's got Ben Feldman. You know, there are people in it who are, I don't know the guy who is the main guy who plays Rob, but you know, the Mike Vogel and Ben Feldman are occupy some space.
I like that for you. Yeah. I'm glad. You know, we've had a few movies that it's like, oh, Lord, here's Joe's whole collection of material, I guess we can call them. So, let's just kind of get into it. So it's a giant monster movie, obviously. That's what we're doing here. But we can imbue it with some meaning. And in fact, I think the director, I think he did an interview with Time. I was just trying to find it, where he said, you know, in an interview with Time, Abrams shares that Cloverfield is meant to be a sort of catharsis for the events of 9/11. And I think that article, I think, was maybe came much later after the film was released. But I think that's very clear in this film. I think that we can, you know, it's an obvious parallel. You got New York hit by some kind of massive, uncontrollable event. There are lots of scenes in the film that echo the first footage we saw of 9/11.
Yeah, the famous, cloud of smoke,
that, like, dust of smoke, as it's like flowing through, the confusion, the trying to figure out what's happening,
the visible destruction of like iconic pieces of the New York City like skyline.
Yes. So, man, that sequence with the head of the Statue of Liberty as it like flies into view and like drags across the street. Such an amazing,
also effective trailer as well. Yes,
very effective. And the poster with like the smoking Statue of Liberty, you know, with the head gone. that was something that was kind of pulled from Escape from LA, like the poster, you know, showed the head of the Statue of Liberty, even though I don't think that's in the movie. I've not seen Escape from LA, but I think that's one of the criticisms is like whatever that scene is not actually in the film. I could be wrong. But I thought I read that somewhere that was like, the movie didn't do that, so we did it in our movie. You know, like we wanted to do that poster justice kind of thing. You know, so I just think like, you know, we can right off the bat just, you know, be like, yes, this is so, definitely a 9/11 narrative. Makes a lot of sense. Again, it echoes Godzilla in that way. Like, how do we process a national tragedy if not through comedy, which certainly was one of the avenues. You know, there were plenty
A national tragedy that was like a national tragedy that was perpetrated on us by a foreign adversary.
Right.
Presumably. I mean, you know,
I mean, Cloverfield does a good job of like kind of playing with that whole conversation that happened in the wake of 9/11. You know, what was real, what wasn't real. I think that we can safely assume that anything that happens like that, there are probably details that are hidden from the public until much later. There are things we know now about what happened during those moments, like what Bush was doing and, you know, the conversations that were happening. You know, we know there was some fuckery afoot.
Yes.
Whether or not what happened is how they said it happened or not, I'm not really interested in too much for this show, other than to say.
Yes.
I will say this, because I got in trouble for 9/11 in my history class when it happened. And I admit I was like, you know, a 17-year-old, like, know-it-all in a way. But at this point, like, at that point in my life, I wasn't like, you know, the radical leftist I can be accused of being now. But I had a very particular worldview at that time, you know, and I knew certain stories were lies. I read things. I talked to, you know, I spent a lot of time around adults, like talking about, you know, so I just had a particular worldview. So when 9/11 happened and they were like, you know, immediately, I mean, as soon as it happened, the very first, like people started, you know, blaming it on, you know, people from the, you know, the Middle East, the Arab world, the Muslim world. Like before, I mean, it was like immediate, you know, it's like the plane crash and it's like, oh, we're being attacked by Arab terrorists. It's like, can we process like all the death that's happening right now? But my initial reaction was, well, that kind of sounds like karma. Like it kind of sound, you know, and my history teacher got very, very upset with me because I was, you know, but I'm like, well, they're already like finding people to blame for this. And it's like we're minutes into it, you know, because they turned on the news. We watched it live, like happening in class. And I was just like, you know, so I feel like it's one of those things where, you know, we're a nation, an imperialist nation that has, you know, hundreds of military bases around the world. We consider ourselves police, you know, world police. You know, there's a lot of very good evidence, you know, to support our interference in other governments and things like that. So when 9/11 happened and a lot of people seemed really shocked, it felt kind of like, you don't think eventually some of the people we've harmed in the choices we've made aren't going to try to fight back in some way?
Yeah.
Like it's kind of, and again, it's sort of the, like when we talked about like King Kong, like, oh, here are the consequences of my own actions coming in, you know, or like Godzilla, like, you know, having a very anti-American like sentiment, like you can't be surprised by that. We edited it out. We fucking censored it when we released King of the Monsters here. But it's like, you can't be surprised by that. Like I imagine the Pikachu thing, you know, like I can't believe all these countries we've been bombing and, you know, murdering civilians left and right are now upset with us. Like, why are they mad at us? Why do they think we're the villain? So if 9/11 happened the way they...
That's a Pikachu thing?
Well, you know, you're not seeing the meme of Pikachu's shocked face.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes.
I'm like, how like, you even know. Then, I like, at 17, I was like, how are people shocked? Like, this is awful. It's a tragedy. Yeah. Like, lots of people died. Lots of terrible, like, things happened. And then, of course, the response to it created even more death, even more destruction, even more, you know, horror in the world that we are still living with the effects of and the consequences of. You know, so it's just one of those things where it's like, Cloverfield, I think really encapsulates like all the horror and the terror of that. And again, allows us to kind of put that all into this like monstrous unknowing thing. Cause yeah. It's like, no matter what you believe happened during 9/11, whether you believe the whole, like what the government said is true, that, you know, a bunch of people hijacked a plane and drove it into it. Or I know plenty of people that are like, the government did this. They blew up the building because of the whole Enron scandal. And we needed a reason to invade, you know, Iraq or Iran or Afghanistan or whoever, And there was a lot of anti-war sentiment before that, and we weren't getting the support. So, hey, you know how we can get the public support? We'll bomb New York and tell everybody it was, you know.
Yeah, whether or not it's a 9/11 is an inside job kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, so again, there's a lot of stuff. And I think Cloverfield does a good job of playing with that imagery of like, what exactly is happening? You know, what story is being told, and like the news, and you know, they kind of play with that in the military.
Even TJ's, TJ Miller says, says, like, I don't watch the news, but like, this could be something we created.
Yeah.
Like, very explicitly saying,
maybe the government made it. You know, we don't know. And he's like hell bent on recording it. So I just think this film does a good job of putting a lot of those anxieties in the post 9/11 world into it. So
one thing that we talked about too, especially when we're thinking about like, you know, obviously we know, like when you see like one of the final moments of the film, you see something crash from outside, you know, from the space. So we're assuming, you know, we are meant to assume or believe that this is like some otherworldly entity. Right. So we were talking about as we were watching it, which one of the reasons why I love watching things in person with you, because we, you know, make sure that we have great conversations there too, is that, you know, how dare we, right? The hubris for us, especially like us being like Americans, but humanity in general, to think that like, you know, to even assume that like the benevolence of like otherworldly travelers, right? Of aliens. Mm-hmm. Because like if there are aliens that are coming, I believe they're going to colonize us the way that we have also colonized folks, or you know, in some way, shape, or form, right? We would like to think that they're a higher intelligence, and that's something I think that science fiction plays with, is the idea of like, you know, we're making aliens in our image, and so, you know, our capacity for destruction and, you know, colonization and all of that. But we would also imprint or portray transfer onto them or project onto them. Thank you. I was like looking for the right word. Project onto them the idea that like we could be better.
Oh yeah, our hopes about our what we could be, that something other, this other creature could come and like teach us how to be better.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, you know, one's Independence Day and one's the Abyss.
Right. Yeah, or E.T. You know, E.T. is one of those kind of more hopeful, like friendly alien sorts of stories that we have. But yeah, I think that's a really good point that this is this is such like a situation. It's kind of more, I think, again, akin to Godzilla, where it's just sort of a response to its environment. And we watch a little bit of the behind the scenes, the making of. And so when they were designing the creature, you know, they're kind of thinking of it as an infant, as like an elephant that's been spooked at the circus and is going on a rampage because it's confused and it's scared and it's in an unknown environment. And who knows how it even fell out of the sky. Like, you know, was it something like dropped from a ship? Is it something that traveled? Like, you know, we don't even know. But the idea is that it's freshly born and, you know, terrified and like, you know, it's being attacked and, you know, by guns and people are screaming and it's a whole thing. So it just creates this really extremely chaotic environment. But it's unlike so many other alien stories, because it doesn't seem to have like a sentience to it. It's not trying to communicate. Maybe it would as it ages.
Just like a child, right? Like, children don't have that capacity. Like, it's unless you give them tools, they can't express to you what they need or want.
Yeah, yeah. Which, again, I think also echoes that sort of like when we think about being victims of imperialism, being victims of colonization, being victims of the bomb, being victims of weapons of mass destruction. You know, you're left with fear, you're left with terror, and you respond to that in lots of different ways. And, you know, so again, that I think this film does a really good job of echoing just a lot. There's a lot going on in it.
Yeah.
That's like clearly there. And there are choices made that I can't say, just like with Godzilla, like this isn't an accident. you know, it's not an accident that these are very purposeful. And so using that sort of imagery. The other thing I think is really cool about Cloverfield is that this is a world, like, we're a year into having the iPhone. And did you get the first iPhone?
No.
Okay. See, I didn't either. I was a BlackBerry user until like 2011 or 12.
Jeez.
Yeah. I'm a creature of habit. So the first phone I got was like one of those Motorola flip phones.
Like a Razr?
And that was in 2005. Okay. No, even the older one. I did eventually get a Razr.
Oh, the really thin one?
Yeah, I got a Razr when it was really thin, but this was kind of more of a thick Motorola flip phone. And I got it in 2005. That was the first time I owned my own cell phone. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to the Razr, and then I moved to the BlackBerry. And it's so gay, but Madonna used a BlackBerry, so I got a BlackBerry.
I'm rolling my eyes.
Madonna used her BlackBerry for even after the iPhone came out. She's still stuck onto that BlackBerry for a long time.
I'm rolling my eyes knowing full well that I've done stuff like that, too.
Yeah,
you know.
So I used BlackBerry for years and years and years, and then I got a job where everything was Apple. All the computers were Apple. Everybody's phones were Apple. And, you know, your phone is messing up our chats, you know, or your phone is not like our phone. You need to get an iPhone. You need to move over to Apple. So I did, and then I never looked back. But anyway, so I don't really know what capabilities the original iPhone had, but it was not the movie studio it is now, I have to imagine. I mean, I know they had cameras and stuff in them, but, you know, I don't know if people were making movies on the first iPhone.
Well, we didn't. I mean, people were. It's so funny now because, like, you look at the people in the background of Cloverfield, and you see them like snapping pictures on their flip phones, like terrible resolution. Mm-hmm. Like, oh fuck, I remember like one time in college because I had my like singular, like not flip but like, you know, just a little brick phone, my blue singular phone that I got when I was in high, like still had the one from high school. I had that thing. And like, man, I remember like the first time that I saw like someone sent me a dick pic, like it was just like grainy, but man, did I hold on to that thing. Kind of wish I still had it as just, you know, from an archival perspective. But like, you know, they're not great, but it's all we had at the time. Like, and now I think, like, you know, again, post iPhone, you know, you don't think that like a phone like that is going to have all these other functions, because I think what was the most important thing for iPhone at the time was the fact that it was had internet. Like, you could have, like, you could just be on, like, you could browse and check your email and all that stuff. And the same thing you could do with a BlackBerry, but it was more user-friendly. Like, it wasn't like, you know, you didn't have to worry about, you know, hitting buttons and, you know, having, like, I have fat fingers, like.
But that still was to come, like, it was still developing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At this time, you know, so I think the cool thing about this film is it does have this sort of, like, again, in the post 9/11 world, suddenly everything was like, if you see something, say something. The Patriot Act, it like created all of this like impetus for the individual citizen. It's like your responsibility to keep us safe. Yeah. Document, document, document. And then, of course, we've seen that grow and shift and change. And we've seen like cell phone footage that years ago would have felt like, you know, a grainy, you know, thing, or, you know, like what you're saying is now like crystal clear journalism used in trials, you know, to, you know, indict like cops that, you know, commit murder, or like other, you know, the behavior of bad people. It's suddenly we live in a world where, yeah, we really document everything, but at the time of Cloverfield that still felt kind of new, you know, like, because HUD really hangs on, like, I have to get everything, you know, because, like, why didn't he drop? I would have dropped that camera and took off, you know, but he, like, really hangs on to it. And there's this real sense of, like, must document this. This is important. And it was like a harbinger of, like, what was to come. Now it's, you know, we all have to take pictures of every little fucking thing we do every single day.
Document our life entirely.
Every strange, you know, stray thought we have has to go on the internet and has to be documented. But I think when this came out, that we still weren't in that world yet.
Yeah. I mean, like, fucking like one of my favorite movies, Tangerine, is shot on an iPhone. Like, I mean, proudly, in the sense that, like, for what they were able to accomplish.
Yeah.
It was like, it's pretty great, in high definition and just like, you know, narratively and all that stuff, like it's pretty great. But again, like you said, like this is, it's an interesting, when you're thinking about the documentation of it, it's like, it doesn't signal what kind of we talk about now, which is the idea of like, you know, this, it's a different type of surveillance,
right?
It's a different type of body power and moving and the surveillance of it all. Whereas like, you know, HUD is doing this because, like, you know, motivated intrinsically because like it needs to, like, I'm here, it's happening, this is something that people are going to want to see.
Yes. Yeah.
And then
they may hide this from us in the future. They may lie about this.
Exactly.
You know, I have to document it.
And the impetus is coming from us, which, like you said, like, plays in nicely to, like, you know, hey, if you see something, say something. And then now you have now where it's like people, that's the first thing that they do. Like, they feel that, like, everyone feels that their opinion or their account of an event, you know, is going to be what, like, other people may want to see go viral.
Yeah.
As it were.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that, like, go viral, especially with this campaign's, like, you know, the whole viral mm-hmm. marketing of it all. So it really took advantage of this kind of burgeoning world that we now live in, where, like, because there's like a nice moment in it where they're on the bridge, I think, where HUD films someone else filming, you know, and you get this like moment of, oh my gosh, there must be 100 other movies being made out there of this night, you mm-hmm. know, other people mm-hmm. trying to document it. And now that's like such a common occurrence. Like, I don't understand why 50,000 people need to film a concert, you know, like, it's just silly. And you're probably never going to watch it again, or you're never going to really truly revisit it. I mean, maybe some people obsessively watch the shaky, terrible sounding clips they record on their phone, but I don't. I mean, I might live stream a little bit of something just to sample and then leave it, but I'm not going to film a whole damn concert. But anyways, that's not the point. I like that. That's a good point, Joe.
Yeah.
You're making points.
I make them.
I don't know. Part of me kind of misses that world, though, where everything wasn't.
I don't post as much.
Documented.
Like,
that's true.
Like, my... I shit post a lot on stories because it's, you know, temporary. But like, as far as like what goes on the actual grid, because you know, I'm an Instagram user primarily, it, you know, it's mostly, it's not really a lot of stuff. Also, like, I saw this meme. I saw this like meme of a tweet that was like, Instagram is a place where people over 30 go to look at videos from TikTok. And I'm like, yep, clocked. That's me. That's me too. But yeah, I also
I understand TikTok.
I don't feel the necessity to document my life, whether it's like, you know, part of me has that, like, you know, that low self-esteem of like, well, what's so good about my life worth documenting? Like, people, like, I mean, you know, as I appreciate the head tilt and the, you know, the purse lip, but
we do want people to listen to our opinions on horror movies.
Here, currently, yes. But like, also the other thing too, it's like, you know, I also kind of like the idea of like, you know, I'll take a few pictures when I go on vacation or see something cool. I do take pictures on my phone, but I'm not posting it because I'm like, this is mine. Like, I'm holding this memory now, and this is something that I don't feel like sharing with other people in the same way that, like, you know, I used to be a more avid photographer. So like being able to like share pictures because like there was an intentionality between like taking a giant camera and out. Now you can just do whatever. And
that's very true.
It, you know, you can still have that same intentionality, but for me, it's like, it's such a, like, you know, fuck this like black mirror here is the thing that I use to like Google recipes and like, you know, masturbate and like all this stuff. Like, it does, you do a lot on it, but I don't feel
our
like
external brains.
Yeah. I don't think like you know, it's not a site for, at least for me, it's not an instrument with which I create art.
Yeah. I like that. I get that. For some people, obviously, you know, I mean, I have a mixed relationship with it, you know, because I do document a lot of my life. I post a lot of things. I promote a lot of things, you know, so I definitely, I don't think I'd be the person in in the middle of this kind of crisis trying to film it. You know, I want to survive. I want to get away from it. So,
yeah, but you, it's that thing about like, you know, my parents always off, my parents sometimes when they talk, when they get on a social media thing, it's not so much a rant as like they just start asking very pointed questions. Like, you know, why would I want to see a picture of their dinner?
Right.
And it's like, it's not that they want, it's not that like they want to share it with you, like that's the whole point, is like, you know, either because they want you to know what they're up to, or you, they want you to also live vicariously through that experience or document it for the future. One thing that I heard recently on a podcast is like, you know, it was this group of artists, they were talking about like, you know, one thing I hate is when like people get on their social media and they say, oh, I'm here again promoting my show, you know, come and see my show.
Right.
And like, you know, kind of hand wringing about it. And they said like, don't do that. Like, be proud that you got work. Be like, these are people who are working comedy. Like, be proud you got work. Be proud someone, you know, be proud of all the hard work that you put into something.
Right.
Is like coming to fruition, and you want to share that with people, and you want them to give, like, here's a way you can tangibly support you, and you, you know, maybe they didn't support you in the creative process, but they're supporting you here. And so that's like how, like, hearing that a few weeks ago, like, it's been changing my mind about how I think about what I post in terms of like our show. I'm working all of my issues out about Fright School right now with you. How our show, it's just like, you know, I'm so proud of the show, and I talk about it in my real life and in my like day job life. And, you know, and I talk about it openly with people, and that's how I do it. But like, right. I like in the ways that I feel like I'm more effective that way too than even social media.
Right. I don't know. Right.
So I appreciate you allowing me the space to detour.
That's perfectly fine. You know, so back to the film.
Thank you.
Feel like I haven't had to say that in a long time, because overall, like, I've really enjoyed these talks. Like, I'm not necessarily a big fan of like huge monster movies, but I think these four conversations that we've had have been really interesting and really fun. Like, I've just really enjoyed, even if some of the readings are obvious.
Yeah.
I, you know, that's fine. Like, I actually really love something that I can really underline and say, like, this proves what we do on this show is a real thing. Like, people do intentionally make horror films to respond to their cultural anxiety, to process trauma, to process national tragedies that we've seen, particularly, again, in Godzilla and Cloverfield, of these two films, of the four, out of the four films we've discussed. You know, I think that's a really good... I just think it's been really fun to talk about.
Well, there's also, like, there's a comfort and certainty.
Yeah. So... So to kind of return to the film, you know, everybody's, it's a lot of running around, a lot of panic, as happens in the immediate aftermath of movies like this. I love the little shots we get of the creature. There's a nice thing from Jaws here, you know, again, pulling from Jaws, like we've seen, like Tremors did, I think, a similar thing, kind of borrowing from, like, kind of keeping the monster a little hidden until, like, especially that end sequence, like right before HUD gets it and we really get a view of the monster. I remember that in the theater so strongly because it was huge. Like, you were really there in that action. And, like, I think about things like my brain, like, how do these movies, like, the people going through this sort of trauma, like, how do you, like, process something like that in the moment? You know, you're seeing people get wiped, you know, off the face of the fucking earth left and right.
Impunity, like, destruction with impunity.
Yeah,
there's always.
Yeah. Yeah. Just taking whoever. And then all of a sudden, this giant fucking creature. So it's like your brain has to, like, process a lot happening at once. And that's, like, you know, in the midst of, you know, awful tragedy, you know, grief and trauma, like, you know, it's kind of the same thing. It's we have to, like, you have to, like, figure out how to wrap your brain around something in a world that has changed within seconds for you. You know, like, I'm going to Japan for this new job, and now I'm fighting a behemoth monster from outer space. Like, it's just, you know, or I went to work this morning and a plane flew through my office window. You know, like, it's just like this trauma and the like how radically our whole world can change in seconds, you know, and how do you process that? And the film, I think, does a really good job of, like, tracking these people as they're, like, are just being constantly put under new stress and under new terror, you know, especially when, like, the lice predator, or I mean, parasitical creatures start falling off of it and running, you know, these spider monster things, whatever they are. I've heard them referred to as lice. I've heard them referred to as like parasites, fleas, you know, some kind of thing that's living on this creature, you know, bites poor Lizzie Caplan and she explodes. Like, how do you, you know, it's like,
her eyes start to bleed. I forgot about the eye bleeding. Oh, no. Yeah. But her death, like, I remember how I felt, and I remember being so affected by like the shot of like her going behind the sheet in the quarantine area and then just like bursting and disintegrating, like liquefying.
Yeah. And we're not even shown that, but you have like such a firm, you know exactly what that looked like. I really enjoyed watching this movie again. Like I said earlier, I've seen it several times, but I had waited because this is a movie I had always intended for us to do. And I kept thinking, oh, we should do Cloverfield. We should do Cloverfield. Or I'd see it like on a streaming service or something and go, oh, I should watch Cloverfield. No, I'm going to wait till we do it for the show again. So I don't think I've watched it in like probably 5 or 6 years since we started doing the show. So it was really fun to revisit. And because it had been so long, it's like it's a fun like journey to go on because you just have this one view. It's not omnipotent. You're just in them as their world shifts and changes. Yeah. It's a fun ride.
And it's not even that he's fighting a monster. It's that I need to go get the girl who like is the love of my life.
Well, yeah, that whole other story, which again, I mean, I feel like all power to you, man. And I don't know how I'd feel. Like, maybe I would want to, you know, like, come back. You know, I mean, we live in the suburbs. So, like, if a monstrous creature, like, you know, washed up in San Diego downtown, like, I'd stay the fuck away from there.
Yeah. I'm coming here. I don't know. Yeah. I'm coming here.
You know, and we're kind of high up where we are. So maybe we'd be okay, safe. Like, you know, maybe it'll destroy that and then go back in the ocean. I have no idea. I don't know what the plan is. But I'm very much on the no side in that. Like, you know, Lizzie Caplan's character is me in a lot of moments of this film. Like, right from the beginning when Hutt is trying to get her to talk and he's like trying to explain and she's just like, no, I understand what you're doing. I don't want to do it. I'm like, yes, I love you. And there are several other moments where she's like, again, it's like echoing life because he keeps bothering her and he keeps following her around with that fucking camera. And I'm like,
trash tells on its, themselves. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And so her whole like thing. And then when it's like, I'm going to go run to where this monster is destroying things to get my girlfriend or my fiance, I guess, or whatever they are.
No, they're friends who like slept together and then it didn't end well.
Who's the one that's his fiance then?
No, that's the brother's girlfriend who no one's unfianced. Like they're Rob and
It's Beth is who I think I said that wrong then earlier. I think I made a mistake saying Lily.
Yeah, Lily.
Beth is the girl. That's
Beth is
trapped.
The girl. Yes, Lily is the long-term girlfriend of the brother who, because in her video, she's like, "I'm not family yet."
Yeah, because well, here it lists her as his fiance, as Jason's fiance. Mm. Anyways, the point is that Lizzie Caplan's character, Marlena, is like, "No, we need to get the hell out of here, not be running towards where it's at. Like, this is a bad idea." And because of that, because he like wants to go save her and those other people, you know, decide to go with him. Of course, all, you know, a lot of terrible things happen to them because of the, because of that choice.
Yeah.
You know, we sacrifice much for love, right? Is that the end all be all of this film? but yeah, I think a lot about being her. Who's the character you feel most,
That I am?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean,
I guess
probably Lily, who's throwing the party.
Who's throwing the party.
Yeah.
It was very tense the whole time that people are doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
You had asked this earlier, like what the response is. So I'm curious about yours. Like if
everything was going down.
Yeah.
And I was like just a bystander, not one
of. Yeah. What are you doing?
We're leaving. Like we're getting out of there. Just because, I mean, like, the added thing of, like parasites that are killing, like, you know, eating people and all that stuff. Like, no, you don't want that. You don't want that. Again, this is probably just, like, post-COVID brain talking, right? But, like, like post-COVID experience talking. But, like, you know, you will never be judged for being too safe. You know what I mean? Like, we will always at the hindsight is 2020. We will always say, like, we want to do something more. We wish we could have done more when this happened. We wish we could have done this when this happened. And in that moment, it's like, no, your panic thing is like, in, you know, for me sitting here in this chair, if things were to go down right now, I'd be like, no, we need to get the fuck out of here. We don't need to go and understand it. We need to. Yeah,
we can wait for that.
We can wait for that, or be told whatever it is we want to be told. And in that moment, like, his priority is like, you know, he doesn't want to lose her. And it's like, right. He's resigned to himself. Potentially resigned himself to the fate that he's never going to make it back.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the very least wants to be there. And so that way she's not alone.
Yeah. I think that, you know, yeah, that's a good point. Because, again, I mean, if the whole city's going up, you might as well be with, you know.
Also, it's like, it's kind of like a shoot your shot thing, right? Yeah. Like, it's just,
yeah.
Don't leave any love unrequited.
Yeah. Well, and it adds the tension to the film. I mean, the film just ends, yeah. You know, because they all run away. No.
Yeah. Oh, fucking HUD. Like, he's just like going around in the party being like, you know, oh, did you know? Did you know that they like,
oh my gosh, yes.
Did you know that they fucked? Did you know that they fucked?
This is why I don't tell anybody nothing.
Yeah.
I don't tell no people nothing that I don't want, you know, if I don't want a secret out. You know,
yeah.
Two can keep a secret if one of us is dead. Yes. That's it. Fucking HUD. And they're like, don't tell anybody. And then like immediately. So stupid.
He's just like not even telling people. No, he's actually telling people. He's just like, hey, did you know they fucked?
And they're like yelling at people, you know, like they had sex. Like they're yelling. It's just nuts. Anyways, you had made a mention earlier. I don't know if you remember, but you tied this back to Nope. Which is the kind of unofficial start to this whole thing, even though not technically. You had made a comment. I think it might have been about surveillance culture.
Yes, so. Exactly. So, like, the, you know, when we started this, you know, unintentionally, Nope is like the first of the five films we're talking about, like big giant monsters. Spoiler alert for Nope, by the way, just throwing that out there. You've had a month to go see it.
Right.
So it's on you, but. Spoiler alert for an undetermined amount of minutes right now. So, like, with Nope, and you see, like, Jean Jacket being, like, or, like, everything and how Nope is, like, explicitly about, like, not only filmmaking and movie making in general, but, like, surveillance culture and, you know, being watched and that feeling of, like, being watched. In this way, it kind of ties in with Cloverfield in the sense of, like, you know, we are the ones who are... You know, we're doing the surveillance, but from like a posterity standpoint, it's like hopefully we can know more about this.
Right.
And in Nope, it's changing it a little bit because it's the added dynamics of like the racial politics and the history of the family,
right?
In the family in it, but it's also they are like, no, we're doing this because we need to survive in a different way. Like we're doing this surveillance because this is like cash money coin that we can. You know, leverage to, you know, this is our Zapruder film, right? This is our, this is what is going to, we are going to be quoted as the people who caught the like most impactful images of this century, if not, you know, all of human existence. And in a similar way, it's like, you know, it's different because like there's a very specific point of view from the like racialized that is on display. In a little bit. In terms of like...
In Nope.
Because Nope is more subtextual and Nope is more like, you know, because their ancestor is the jockey, right?
Right.
Their ancestor is the jockey who went unnamed or like went unknown for so long until they're the ones to be there. So it's very important for them to have that ownership of it and for people to know who they are. Whereas like, you know, this guy just gets to be like, you know, oh, like... white audience surrogate, like capturing everything.
Right.
And it's not necessarily even about like, you know, he doesn't even mention his name when he's like about to make his like, you know, if anyone finds this, I'm dead. Like he you know, I mean, you know, things happen, but like he's more kind of in service to us and it's a different type of surveillance.
Yeah. No, very good point. I agree. Yeah. Yeah. I really like that you made that connection, just because, again, I like when you make connections. That's
I mean,
great.
Like, see how it, like, you know, we're sometimes, sometimes when we're making shit up sometimes, but sometimes it really works.
Yeah, sometimes it all comes back around, you know, kind of completes the loop. So I actually think that's a great place to sort of wrap up the conversation. I mean, I guess we'll continue to explore this as we visit. There are other giant monster movies that I think are worth having conversations about. We kind of talked a little bit about King Kong, about like the masculinity, and there's obviously lots of other things we can discuss within toxic masculinity of giant monster movies. Mm-hmm. You kind of brought that up a little bit, and a lot of times these monsters are referred to as he, so kind of what does that say about a giant rampaging he energy, male energy,
I think,
destroying a city?
It's like, you know, why are we ascribing like a he pronoun, right, to that? Is this one, like, are we, because it's so significant, we automatically assume it's male, but because it's a negative connotation, is this our subconscious way of like identifying it with masculinity and its toxicity?
Yeah. And we will,
in this TED Talk, I will.
Right. But you can hear us discuss this if you go over to our Patreon and watch or listen to our Colossal episode with Anne Hathaway, that film. Not with her. She's not on the show. I don't know why I put it that way. But Anne Hathaway's in the film Colossal, which
is she?
Is sort of about these.
Or is she? You got to go to Patreon. You got to get that Patreon.
we're talking all about toxic masculinity within the giant monster. So you can hear more about that conversation over there. Until then, you can revisit King Kong to think about the ways masculinity is presented, particularly black male masculinity in Kong and in giant monster movies. Oh my gosh. So look at that. Another unit wrapped and completed.
Yeah. So can I summarize a little bit?
Sure.
So like, nope, the monster is, well, I won't go to nope, right, but King Kong. The monster is a representation of, like, you know, the encroaching black masculinity or black male desire, and how we must protect white women from that specifically.
Yes, I think we can critique it that way.
Godzilla is, the monster of, like, of one scientific advancement that ultimately, unchecked scientific advancement that, like, can be used, humans can use it for, to perpetrate violence.
Yes, massive violence.
Massive violence, but also just, like, you know, the sins of, like, a nuclear age as well.
Yes.
Tremors. Was Tremors, and Tremors was Tremors, probably some gay shit in there that you can quote me on that. And then you have Cloverfield, which is dealing with post 9/11 anxiety.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And we got, again, we did, something that was sort of, you know, giant monster from a jungle island kind of vibe, mm-hmm. Giant monster from the sea, giant monsters from underground, terrestrial, and giant monster extraterrestrial from space. So we got all the anxieties.
Yeah.
You know, lots of stuff going on in all these movies. So that was really, really fun. Really, really fun conversation. So thank you as always for being part of it. And dear listener, we thank you, and good night.
Good night.
Fright School is produced by Joshua Napier and Joe Farron.
Our intro was edited by Davey Boy Productions.
Our logo was designed by Jamie Channel Guzman.
Episodes are edited and engineered by Joe Farron.
Fright School is produced in terrifyingly beautiful San Diego, California. Ha ha ha!